David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 185 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. We have a long interview this week, so let's just get right to it. Jim West is a New York-based activist who has critiqued several disease models, infectious disease models. We worked together on West Nile virus around the time of the 1999 so-called New York epidemic of West Nile. And it was Jim who got me started questioning whether polio was an infectious epidemic. I was reluctant at first, but when I saw the research that he had done, I became more enthusiastic over time. And recently I was at a virus critiquing conference in the south of France, and I gave a presentation on, among other things, well, polio and an epidemic of the 1600s in Milan, Italy. And because the work I did on polio was at least stimulated by Jim's research, I decided that we should have a conversation together and put our heads together on polio. So welcome back to the show, Jim.
Thank you very much for having me over here. Thank you.
Yes. So one of the first slide in my section on polio was the timeline. So let's go through it slowly and carefully, because I think most people don't really have a clue about the polio timeline, and it's quite revealing. So the U.S. published statistics, I forget exactly where they come from, it's U.S. Vital Statistics or something, shows that only a handful of cases of polio were found before around 1907, which was the year when Lance Diner and Popper claimed proof that polio was caused by a virus. So what was your finding on what were the original polio cases in the United States?
Like the earliest cases?
Yeah, like what did you find in terms of the earliest cases? I thought you had said there were some in the late 1800s that were being monitored.
Right. There were cases. I think there's a date for the first polio epidemics recognized, and they were in the 1800s. Or, yeah, I think it was 1800s. There's an official date, and then I think there's some challenge to that there might have been earlier. I think it was after 1868, you know.
Yeah, the first number I was able to find was 61 cases in 1893, and then 177 in 1894, and then it dropped to like 30 to 60 cases up till 1907, when it became 3,000 cases, suddenly.
Okay, and where was this?
I think this was, let me see, I have a reference here. This was a document, a very interesting paper from 1979 called The Epidemiology of Poliomyelitis, Enigmas Surrounding Its Appearance, Epidemicity, and Disappearance. The problem I had was that this is a graph, so I was taking the numbers off the graph, which is not very accurate, but I was able to get like the basic approximate number off the graph, and I don't know where this guy got his numbers from in 1979.
Huh. Right.
I can send you that paper if you want.
Sure.
Yeah.
Any time.
Yes. So, but you had said that the first pesticide sprayer, and of course pesticides play a big role in alternative explanations of the polio epidemic, was patented around the late 1800s.
Right. It's like a donkey thing that they would pull it around on a cart, and start doing mass pesticide spraying began around 1868.
Mm-hmm.
And they were spraying arsenic water and soap solutions.
Right. Like these are two separate pesticides, because soap sounds like a relatively non-toxic.
Soap, yeah, but they would mix them also.
Okay.
And the idea of arsenic soap goes back to the ancient times for use in tanning. As a curiosity, I thought I'd throw that out there.
What would they use arsenic in tanning for?
To preserve the leather.
Right, because arsenic kills everything. So I guess it would reduce the risk of the tan material having a fungus or bacterial infestation that would damage the leather.
Right. And I think that might account for those biblical descriptions of skin diseases is the arsenic on the leather, you know.
Right. I mean, we can go back to ancient times, right?
Everywhere you look.
Pre-Roman Empire. I've seen a picture from an Egyptian, what do they call those things, where they carve
hieroglyphics,
which showed what looked like a polio victim. And that would probably be, I don't know, when 1000 or 2000 BC or something like that. But
right, and there are actual ancient writings where they describe paralysis following the inhaling of metal vapors, like mercury metal vapors.
Well, that's interesting.
Anyways,
so we can agree that there were a few cases before 1907, but they were measured in the tens, as far as I can see. And they started to be measured in the thousands around 1907. And the first huge epidemic that, the first of really only of two in the United States, was in 1916, where I have the rate at just over 40 cases per 100,000, which is actually more than the 1952 epidemic in terms of the number of cases per 100,000, even though the population had grown by 1952, so the total number of cases was greater.
Right.
And
yeah, there was a big spike in 1916.
Yes, and...
Oh, no, was it 1916? That was the date, 1916.
1916, yeah, a rate of 41.1 cases per 100,000.
Right.
So what happened? I mean, 1916 was in the middle of the First World War, but why so many polio cases? Because the years before and after that, the rate didn't go over 10 again until the 1930s.
Right.
So it's dramatically different.
Yeah, it's the biggest spike is that 1916 fiasco.
And did you have a hypothesis about why something strange happened in 1916?
Well, you know, there's an interesting conspiracy theory that I could, that I have, which is... it might have been a strategically allowed sloppiness in the handling of chlorine, because they were just installed a big chlorine plant, which was necessary for World War I, which was ongoing.
Right, like chemical weapons were used. Mustard gas and chlorine were used in World War I as chemical weapons, and nobody batted an eye about that.
Right, and they were using chlorine in lubrications. Chlorinated hydrocarbons was a budding industry, and they're using it in grain silos to kill bugs that might be growing in grain silos. They were using chlorinated chemicals.
Okay, so could have been some mass poisoning, but it's hard to say with, let me see how many cases that would be. I think around 29,000 cases. I don't have any information on the geographical distribution of those cases, so how...
Mostly New York region were the cases, and I didn't formally do this. I just roughly did it out on paper and thought about it and stuff. But there, I might have mentioned it somewhere, but there is a parallel death rate, which is parallel to the deaths in the there was like a huge slaughter going on there in World War One with these machine guns and
right
new techniques and all that. And yes. I was wondering if they were using the polio epidemic as a way to sort of lock down the civilian population so they would not rebel against the ongoing World War One industrial games that were going over there. But it just so happens that the peak of death in World War One, in the great, there's these great battles,
right? Mm-hmm.
was parallel to the death rate of polio in New York.
Well, I mean, I guess the only connection I could bring was that the manufacturing of poisons, and in wars, poisons are not just used directly as chemical weapons, but a lot of toxic chemicals are used in the production of explosives and things like that. So I might have shown a peak of production of those things, too. So we really don't know why there was this isolated 1916 epidemic, even though we could discuss possibilities. What, I guess I don't know if it's possible.
Yeah, no, I think that's a, there tends to be it's between carelessness and I was just wondering, you know, I mean, it's just something that I put out there as a possibility that could be a part of the military operation could be domestic. You know, of World War One.
I'm not sure I buy that because the propaganda, the pro-war propaganda. I remember reading about, women who would walk around towns, and when they'd see a young man who obviously wasn't enlisted because he was still on the streets, they'd give him a white rose or something to indicate cowardice. So there was a huge effort to get everybody. Every young man to enlist so they could go get killed in the fields of France. In Canada, there was a lot of pushback from Quebec because the French weren't so enthusiastic about why they should fight for the king. This we're talking here about the United States, and I think support. Well, I guess the United States came into the war pretty late, right? So,
yeah.
Was it around 1916 they came into the war?
I don't know when they actually jumped in there. I think it started getting heavy around 1914 in general.
Right, but the U.S. wasn't involved in the war for a while. Anyway, I guess we're just showing our ignorance of history here. But let's move on to the 1952 epidemic.
Right.
Because that one, I think we have a much stronger handle on what might have been happening.
But just to recap the 1916, mm-hmm. I do think that it's pretty, there is a lot of obvious possibilities of chlorine being the cause because it was unprecedented production of chlorine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the symptoms of chlorine do match and chlorine compounds do match polio symptoms,
Right. I can definitely see that being a lead, and I can also see that when something like chlorine was first used, people would not at all be really aware of just how deadly this compound was. And so they would probably be very careless with it because most people had not handled anything.
No regulations.
Right. Of course, we don't need regulations if we listen to your current president. So anyway, 1952 was the best remembered, best documented epidemic. The rate was almost 40 cases per 100,000. 37 per 100,000 was the actual number. Mm-hmm. And just to emphasize, this was before the vaccine had even been field trialed. But let's talk about some possibilities, because you investigated organochlorines like DDT. And do you want to talk about the history of things like DDT throughout World War II and then afterwards?
Well, Well, DDT was invented in Germany actually a long time ago, back in the 19th century, but it never supposedly gained any traction as a use as a pesticide until World War II. And the production of all of what I call the persistent pesticides, which is DDT, BHC, and arsenic, and those kind of chemicals that don't just wash away with the rain, so they call them persistent pesticides. The production of those parallels the incidence of polio for about 32 years.
Yeah, you have a graph that shows, I think, DDT production from 1944 as at zero up till 1968 when its registration was canceled, with a peak around, looking at the graph here, 1951, I guess, would be the peak. And, right. Of course, we're talking about a 1952 polio epidemic. So when did DDT become in civilian use? Because I believe during World War II it was restricted to the military.
Right, they used it in the military. And then after World War II, I think it was immediately starting to be sold in the United States. Supposedly, the FDA or the agricultural departments had ruled against the use of DDT, but it didn't matter. It supposedly was just so popular that private industry just overran government regulations and just ignored them.
And that was the era where you could buy underwear and paint with DDT already in it, so you would be protected at all times.
Oh, yeah.
From insects.
It's crazy, yeah. They had songs that said DDT is harmless. Everybody thought it was a wonder chemical.
But what you're saying is that it actually came out of favor pretty quickly, because you're showing the production peaking in 1951 and then dropping dramatically around 1956.
Right. Production was still going up, actually, but at that time, the application was shifted and the sales were shifted out of the United States, going more to agricultural countries, I guess, like Latin America, whatever.
So you're not really talking about DDT production, you're talking about DDT consumption in the United States.
Well, the graph is barely, basically, the DDT production, which paralleled usage in the United States up until the mid-1950s, when people got a handle on its toxicity and they began to replace it with the organophosphate pesticides.
Right, okay.
So there's a sharp non-usage in the mid-50s.
A rapid decline in usage. You also show adipose or fatty tissue levels, which you say peaked in the mid-1950s and then slowly declined, but never went back to zero because, of course, the organochlorine chemicals are in the environment now and still being used in the third world.
Right.
So we're still exposed to these things, and they do get stored in fat.
Right. They slowly metabolize, but it's like a half-life situation, so like radioactivity.
Right. And I also believe I think that when you lose weight quickly, that can cause toxicity, because a lot of these things would be flushed out into your body at that time.
Established concept, right, that fasting can be a problem if you're poisoned.
Right. So who was monitoring the adipose tissue levels in the United States, and when did they start doing this?
There was an adipose tissue survey done, I think, I don't know who, I forgot, I forgot to put that website up right now, and I'm not even looking at it. But there is an official adipose survey that was done at that time. That's where I got the data.
Right, but do you remember when it started?
Well, all I can think of is just to look at my graph and see what I wrote there. I think I put all the available data.
You say that the levels were estimated from 1944 to 1950, so it implies that they started monitoring adipose levels in 1950, which must mean that they had concerns about these chemicals, that the fact that they were monitoring them in people's bodies. Somebody was concerned about it.
Right. They're doing it, yeah.
Right, and this is presumably another branch of the U.S. government.
Yeah. Well, DDT was banned from the United States, and that ban was just ignored, you know, so, you know.
What do you mean it was ignored? I mean, you can't buy DDT very easily anymore. I'm sure if you really wanted to get some, you could, but you can't go to... You can't go to a garden store and buy a DDT. You can buy lots of other toxic chemicals.
Yeah. Supposedly, DDT was extremely popular, and I think it was publicized as a wonder chemical. And anybody could make it, actually, in their garage by just mixing chlorinated chlorine compounds with petroleum products. Supposedly, it's very easy to make.
Okay, probably not very safe to make, judging by the starting compounds. But I guess if you were a backyard chemist, you could make your own.
Yeah, no, I've seen the instructions in a. You know, I had a book that just showed how to make it.
Yes.
And that was, you know.
Maybe the anarchist's handbook where they show you how to make a hydrogen bomb as well.
Right. Supposedly, it was just overwhelming public demand. That's the overwhelming the governmental advice.
Yeah, I mean, I think at that time there was very little awareness of ecology, and there's two real problems with DDT. You have your backyard with mosquitoes, and obviously your instinct is, if I can have a non-toxic chemical that will get rid of all the mosquitoes, and I can sit out in the backyard, then that's really good. But even if it was non-toxic, the problem is that insects form an important part of the food chain. So disrupting insects does have ecological problems on things like birds.
Right.
But as we know, that DDT wasn't non-toxic, so now you're killing a lot of beneficial insects and you're poisoning birds.
And the predators of the... Of mosquitoes, the dragonfly.
Right, and that's when we learned about the fact that poisons get concentrated up the food chain. And that's why the California condor, for example, is the most endangered bird, because its eggshells were fragile due to the presence of chemicals. And they were there at the top of the food chain. Like there's nothing that eats a live condor, because no bird is big enough to get them, and no animal can get into the air to get them.
Huh.
So that's when people learned about the dangers of these chemicals in the environment. They probably are, you know, a bird that eats a mosquito is one thing, but then that bird gets predated by something else, which gets predated by something else, and that's when these things really start to concentrate up.
Yeah, and Rachel Carson was writing her book, to publicize the dangers of these chemicals.
Right. Anyway, let's switch to the 1954 field trial. And I don't know if you've ever read the 1954 field trial report, but I did actually manage at one point to get a copy.
Yeah, I read it a couple of years ago. We went through it actually a little bit.
Right. So in 1954, the epidemic was down to about 25 per 100,000 in terms of the rate of polio in the United States, or 24 per 100,000. So we're starting at 37 in 1952. We've already had a significant drop to 1954 without any action that could have explained that drop, that it was a natural drop, or at least a drop that had nothing to do with anything that health authorities had done about polio.
Right.
And I think, I have the exact number, that there were 2 million people involved in the field trial. And the field trial involved what they called the observed group, where they vaccinated grade 2 and then they observed grades 1 and 3. And then there was the so-called placebo group of about 700,000 people, where they supposedly blindly vaccinated supposedly half the group, and then the other half was supposed to be a placebo. But in reality, about 200,000 were vaccinated, 200,000 received the placebo, and 300,000 refused to be vaccinated. And then the most interesting thing that I found about this was that the big claim of success in the polio epidemic was not, they had two classifications of polio. There was non-paralytic and paralytic, and non-paralytic was things like intestinal disturbances and headaches and things like that could be explained by a virus or by exposure to a toxic substance. But there was really no difference between the vaccinated and the placebo in the cases of non-paralytic polio. There was only a difference in the paralytic cases. And this is where it's supposedly a slam dunk for the vaccine, because the vaccinated rate was 16 out of 100,000. So 16 paralytic cases out of 100,000 vaccinated. And placebo was 55, which is a lot greater. But the thing that really gets me curious is that the not inoculated, the 330,000 people who refused to be vaccinated with a vaccine or placebo because they didn't know which one they would get, that rate was 36. Why would people who were not inoculated have such a lower rate of polio than the placebo cases?
Right. Well, they were not in the clutches of the medical system, I guess.
Well, I have another hypothesis. This was obviously a field trial on children. And up till, I think, the 1970s, children did not routinely receive a social security number. So you have the total number of people in the trial was 749,000, of which there were 267 paralytic polio cases. And when one came in, which didn't come in through the field trial, like a report of polio would come in from a hospital or something, you then had to track down exactly which child had been vaccinated in which classroom, which could have been a very difficult thing in the pre-computer age. How would you actually accurately be able to track down John Smith's polio? He's from this town. What class was he in? What line number was he on the form? Did he receive the placebo or the vaccine? My concern is that in cases where it was difficult to assign somebody, they would say, oh, well, probably he received the placebo because he would have been protected if he received the vaccine. And if 38 cases had been misallocated, so if 38 cases came in and they didn't know, so they said, this is the placebo, not the vaccinated, then that would completely erase the supposed benefits of the vaccine just by misallocating cases. So basically a hidden bias. Somebody at a higher level would make an executive decision saying, this must be a child injected with a placebo. And you only had to do that 38 times to create this vast difference between placebo and vaccinated. So that's my hypothesis of what happened.
Right. Sounds good.
Okay. and it's based on the fact that, as I said, that the not inoculated children had a much lower rate of paralytic polio than the placebo, and that doesn't make any sense. Unless, of course, the placebo causes polio. Which is highly unlikely, because I believe that the placebo was the vaccine without the actual biological component. So if there were any side effects of the placebo, they should have been found in the vaccinated as well.
Right, right. Yeah, I see you highlighted in yellow those relevant numbers.
Yes, those to me are kind of the smoking gun.
Right.
But you can't,
it's hard to get more data on that motivation, right?
Yes, I mean, I've been trying to read, I've read the polio report, and I want to read it more to see if I can find some, indications that there were any problems with the allocation of a case to either placebo or vaccinated, or indeed concluding that this child was just not inoculated at all. I mean, another thing that I found was that the labels on the vials, although they were supposedly blinded, which is very important for a field trial, they actually contained a code, and the first digit told you whether it was placebo or vaccine. So you have to assume that nobody knew this, that this was kept a deathly secret in the vaccine field trial center, and that nobody out in the field would be able to tell the difference between a vaccine and a placebo.
But they actually did know.
Well, I can't say that, but it clearly now, if you were to do a trial like this and it was so obvious how to tell vaccine versus placebo, then that would be considered,
right,
completely bogus, because it would not truly be blinded, and yet that's what they did.
You're telling everybody, that this person was inoculated.
Right, and given the panic, I think the panic of one of the parallels between polio and AIDS is that the panic was very similar. Like, people would refuse to send their children to the swimming pool because they thought the swimming pools is where you got polio. Interestingly, that swimming pools use chlorine. I hadn't thought of that connection before.
Right. And there was a story I remember reading about a Olympic champion at the age of 27 being paralyzed. He was a swimming champion, and I couldn't help but think that kid was probably practicing in his backyard swimming pool, 10 hours a day, full of chlorine,
Yeah, and maybe his dad or whoever, set up the pool was one of those people who thought if a little bit of chlorine is good, a lot of chlorine is even better.
Oh, yeah,
The carelessness of modern people with toxic chemicals is quite amazing, and I think it's caused a lot of deaths and injuries, because
Definitely. People
just don't understand how dangerous these things are.
Plus the chemicals that are involved in just making a swimming pool,
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, anyway. But we're jumping off track again, I guess.
Yes. Okay,
so much low-lying fruit,
Right.
Grass,
So in 1955, they started vaccinating. The field trial was declared a success. Very soon, they got the permission to vaccinate. But by this time, the epidemic was at a rate of 18, which was less than half of what it was in 1952. And a total of about 400,000 children had been vaccinated during the field trial. So even if that had been successful, that's nowhere near enough to have any noticeable impact on the epidemic. So the epidemic dropped in half without really any involvement from the medical establishment. And it actually rose a little bit in 1958 and 1959 before dropping again in 1960 and never rising again.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of that sloppiness in their in what seems to be like propaganda events, but they know that they'll tidy up all the things that don't, just with the literature, they'll just sort of reset the connections so they appear to make sense,
Well, yeah, I think most people, the story is there was an epidemic, they came out with a vaccine, the epidemic went away. And it's clearly causal, but you cannot have causation when the events have occurred before the factor that you're saying is the cause. So if the vaccine was the cause of the drop, no, it can't be, because it can't be the cause of all the drop, at least, because you'd already dropped by half before you really started to vaccinate.
And right.
I actually found a paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association that was complaining that by 1960, less than half the vulnerable population had been vaccinated.
Oh, yeah, right.
And by 1960, the epidemic was at a rate of 1.8 per 100,000, which is less than 5% of the 1952 epidemic. So without vaccinating more than half the population, the epidemic was reduced to 5% of its level. And
yes, right. Well, along those lines, I did, you know, I've done these DDT poliographs and et cetera, but I also did I created a formula called the Vaccination Efficacy Index.
Mm-hmm.
It was my own in sort of an invented formula, you know, basically incorporating the conversation you're generating right now into a formula and then plotting it on a graph, the vaccine efficacy, if mm-hmm. it worked at all.
Right.
And then matching that up with the polio rate, and they don't match, you know?
Yes, I don't think anything matches. One thing, like moving on from the... did you study... there was a thing called the Cutter incident, I think in around 1958, when the polio rate was rising. And that was that the Cutter company, which I was familiar with as a child because they produced insect repellent, it was very popular, that their vaccine had to be pulled off the market because a lot of people getting the vaccine were getting polio.
That was a big scandal, yeah.
But none of the other vaccines were pulled off the market. It was assumed that it was just this one vaccine that was causing this. And the assumption was that they weren't killing the polio virus properly, because I think they added formaldehyde to kill the polio virus.
Oh, right. They had not... there was also, a criticism that they might not have filtered the vaccine well enough, and... some of the viruses were just too alive or something.
Right. My take is that people are jumping to the assumption that if a vaccine causes polio, that it must necessarily be the biological component that's doing that.
Right.
And I'm not at all convinced of that. I think you'd have to look at what the chemicals are, including formaldehyde, that are being injected into the body, or the possibility of severe allergic reactions occurring.
Right, that's where the anti-vaccinationists end up being propagandists for the virus paradigm, because they're complaining about improperly made vaccines and bad batches and all that, when really it's probably the chemicals in the vaccine.
Yeah, at least people should be looking at what the chemicals were and whether they could plausibly cause this. I mean, did Cutter, because they were having, you know, supposedly positive polio results even in the vaccine indicating they thought the polio was alive, did they add more formaldehyde to try to fix this problem?
Right.
Pardon me.
Sure.
So I wanted to talk about seasonality, because I think you started me on this, but in the polio field trial, they have a graph of the cases in 1952, 53, and 54, and what it shows is a huge peak in August and September, and the two surrounding months, July and October, also had large numbers, and then the next surrounding months, June and November, had lower cases, and then the rest of the year was much lower. So in 1952, for example, according to this graph, between January and May, there were 100 to 200 cases per month in the United States. Then there were 500 in June, 2100 in July, 3,200 approximately in August and September. then back down to 2,500 in October, back down to 600 in November, 300 in December, and then the next January, so January 1953, it was under 100 again. And right. I think this is the strongest evidence that this is an environmental disease.
Yeah, you're referring to the graphs by Toomey.
No, I'm referring to the graphs. Well, I'm referring to the graphs that are actually in the 1954 field trial report.
Oh, okay.
They actually graphed 1952, 53, 54. They graphed the actual case counts for those 3 years. But we can talk about Toomey. Maybe you can describe what Toomey found.
Well, actually, he found a correlation between fruit harvest and polio incidence. I believe that was the gist of what he... and the seasonality having an agricultural correlation there.
Yeah, he has a rather strange circular graph, which is quite clever,
right.
I think. And he shows on the left-hand side, so the lower left, August, September, October, he shows the polio season and the apple-growing season. And on the right-hand side, January, February, March, this is the southern hemisphere where the growing season is obviously at the other end of the year.
Right. Well, you know, the one thing about Toomey I do recall was sort of a humorous thing because I think he's avoiding the toxicological component, and he did come up with the idea that he thought that there's something about like a fruit skin that was sort of a catalyst for the disease.
Yes.
And he thought that there might be something in the fruit skin, about fruit skin, that caused polio or promoted polio. And I thought that was sort of funny because he's so obviously avoiding the concept of pesticides that are going to be on that fruit skin.
And this was published in 1933.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, it shows that this phenomenon was well documented and it had been correlated with the fruit harvest season. And I think that's important. Like you might, this is not correlated with the growing season because, as I said, the peak was in August and September. You know, the growing season and in many cases the application of the early fertilizers and pesticides might be March, April, May. But here we have the harvest season. And other people implied that what was happening is that people were applying pesticides too late, not washing the fruit properly. Something like that could be causing this this problem if it was indeed pesticides. I also have another guy. I think you also pointed me at this guy, Gebhardt, who published in 1946. And
right.
Gebhardt was much more explicit. He superimposed the harvest season in California, New York, and Utah over... the epidemic in California, the 1943 epidemic. And here it peaks at 5,900 cases in September in California. But he shows the strawberry harvest, the cherry harvest, the peach harvest, apricots, going on to the apple and pear harvest late in the summer or into the fall, actually.
Right. Strawberries, apples, peaches, and pears seem to correlate with a peak, and those are all a heavily pesticided using arsenic at that period in 1933.
Yeah, well, 1943.
43. Oh, yeah. And lead compounds also they were using. I know that a lot of the apple orchards in the New York area are what were previously apple orchards or even the modern ones that are legacy orchards, the soil is considered to be highly polluted with lead compounds, you know. And in some cases, they advise not even building new structures over those areas, you know.
Which is...
all the chemicals in the ground, you know.
Kind of ironic. Yes, I can remember I was always, if I went camping with my parents... quite often, and sometimes there'd be an orchard next door, and I'd steal some fruit. My mother was always anxious that I washed it. I didn't see the necessity to do that, and I'm sure she was thinking, well, there could be bacteria on it or something like that, not that there could be pesticide residues, not that all would be removed. But certainly, you know, some of it would be removed by washing. And there was another paper I found which was talking about another issue, which was the rarity of multiple cases in one family. Like you would expect that if DDT was infectious, that, you know, the baby comes down with it, and then a couple of weeks later after the incubation period, the rest of the family comes down with it. But that was actually extremely rare.
Yeah, and there are some early studies where it's stated that, yes, there was a polio epidemic, but there's no epidemic pattern.
Yes, and in one paper that I read where they looked, I think it was in Utah, where they looked at some of these, they found like a case in a child who lived with his mother and father 75 miles, you know, on a sheep farm 75 miles from the nearest town. And they rarely, you know, they went into town about once a month to pick up supplies and things like that. So they correlated these isolated cases with the consumption of unwashed fruit. That was a connection that they made.
Yeah.
So the fruit connection is very strong. And going back to the multiple cases in one family, they did say that when there were multiple cases, they often occurred at the same time, which is hard to explain by an infectious epidemic, because it would mean that if there's a two-week incubation period, then that entire family were all in contact with the infected person at the same time, which seems unlikely. But if it was environmental, if people were eating contaminated fruit, then you would expect them all to come down at the same time.
Right, and like really, like within the hour, they'll all start vomiting or something. And you
yes.
know, and they'll all get within an hour, and then that's hard to claim that would be due to a virus.
Yes, well, here's so SCOBY, which was, you got me onto SCOBY. So in 1952, he wrote, most of the multiple polio cases in families were found to have developed at the same time, suggesting means other than contact as the mode of spread. Here's Gebhardt in 1946 saying, two cases investigated in a 1940s Utah epidemic clearly had no contact with another polio cases. These were people living in very isolated areas. But both had eaten unwashed fruit. a 2005 document, a book, I think, by a guy named Wilson, said that polio at mid-20th century typically struck only one member of a family. But here's perhaps the most interesting quote that I found. This is from 1948, where a guy says, Clark is his name, one patient stated that her dog had been paralyzed at the same time as her onset of polio. Another man had chickens with what he called range paralysis.
Uh-huh. And this was what year?
This is 1948. That somebody is stating that animals were all being paralyzed at the same time as humans.
Yeah, by now DDT and these chemicals they're all over the farm.
And actually the same phenomenon was reported with mad cow disease. I think the first case of mad cow disease occurred, but at the same time other animals on the same farm were having similar symptoms.
Right, animals and humans would tend to have these polio epidemics at the same time.
Yeah, so really I think the evidence that polio is an environmental epidemic is very strong. And one of the other things I looked at, and I don't know how I got onto this, but I discovered acute flaccid paralysis. And just as a matter of interest, I was talking to a woman who's a doctor who actually comes from Nigeria, where polio is quite common, and I asked her if she knew what acute flaccid paralysis was, and she said no, which surprised me a little bit. Here's the definition of acute flaccid paralysis is polio. without the detection of the virus. In fact, I think the WHO says polio-associated acute flaccid paralysis and non-associated acute flaccid paralysis.
I know. That really points out the obviousness of an environmental component.
Right. So if we look at the WHO's success at eliminating the virus, you see, you know, some number of cases on the graph, because I'm mapping it against AFP without the virus, we're talking maybe 1,000 or so cases in the 1990s, dropping to a handful of cases in the 2000s. But they started monitoring acute flaccid paralysis without the virus in 1996. And at that time, they had, I think, about 15,000 cases a year. And in 2011, it hit 100,000 cases, and it stayed above 100,000 cases since 2011. It seems to be relatively stable now, not either increasing or decreasing.
Yeah, it is amazing. Just the polio epidemic and, well, all of these disease paradigms, they so obviously avoid the toxicological component or the possibility. And I guess the only benefit of these paradigms is that it allows people to recognize and talk about death and mortality while protecting industry. And so they can work with it and try to create a compromise between industrial and human health need.
I think the industrial needs are higher, but
right.
Here's the question. Why do we care so much about the poliovirus when there's only a handful of cases every year, and we don't care about acute flaccid paralysis when there's over 100,000 cases of unexplained paralysis in young people a year? Why does the world not care about acute flaccid paralysis? I mean, have you ever seen an article in a mainstream newspaper or magazine or website?
Oh, yeah. Right. Well, for one thing, the mere existence of AFP sort of points to the environmental factor, because they can't pin it on a virus.
Yeah, I mean, the World Health Organization, they did I have a paper from 1993 where they tried to look in detail at acute flaccid paralysis, and they came up with a laundry list of potential causes, and of course, they listed polio as one of the causes. So that clearly, it's important, because they're clearly saying acute flaccid paralysis is polio. They talked about vaccine adverse reactions, snake bites, and they also listed insecticides. But all kinds of other things, you know, they obviously listed lots of viruses because they'd like to think that what it was. But my question is, or this is my hypothesis, the reason why, I'll answer my own question. The reason why the West does not care about acute flaccid paralysis is because they don't see it as affecting them. If it's not an infectious epidemic, the fact that 100,000 people in Latin America, Africa, India, Asia, 100,000 children are becoming paralyzed is not a problem for the West unless it's infectious, in which case it could come across the oceans and kill us.
Well, okay, but how about this? I have another explanation. That's just basically you can't make money off of AFP, but you can make money off of polio. You can't sell a vaccine. You can't sell a product with regard to AFP, but you can sell products
Right.
Polio vaccine program.
Yes.
Nobody's making money, so why would anybody want to write anything about AFP?
I guess that's another reason. Like if they came up and said AFP has a single cause, it's not polio, but it's another virus, we could generate a vaccine. Or maybe it's something for which there could be a drug of some kind.
They need to find out a AFP virus.
Right, and then we can be interested in it. But I also think that the reason why the population is not concerned about it is because they don't see it as affecting them. Like it's very easy for people to raise money for polio, and of course there's two reasons. The overt reason is, you know, children in third world countries shouldn't be becoming paralyzed when they're young. Obviously, that ruins their life, especially where so many people are economically vulnerable. But if that was the reason, then people would be outraged that The AFP had gone from under 20,000 cases to over 100,000 cases in a couple of decades, and nobody appeared to be doing anything about it. So I really think it's hypocrisy when the West sheds tears over polio, and they don't shed tears over AFP. If they really cared, they would care more about AFP because there's more cases.
But the people in charge of motivating the shedding of tears are all going to be basically medical journalists who are in bed with the medical products and chemical sales. You know, all this journalism is what causes the tears to be shed.
I would like to think there's some journalists who would take this up. I mean, if the World Health Organization said, you know, these are probably mostly due to the careless handling of pesticides or pesticide contamination or something like that, then I think there would be a journalist who would pick that up and say this is shameful, what's going on. But the fact that they've spread the blame amongst snakes and insecticides and vaccine adverse reactions and a whole pile of viruses means that there's nothing for a journalist to get their teeth into. I mean, who are you going to blame for this when no cause?
I think most of these journalists are really press release facilitation agents.
I guess that's a good way to put it, especially with medicine, which they don't understand. Most of them are not scientifically trained. And they don't want to go up against these very smart people who work for these medical organizations.
Well, they know that's where they're getting fed. That's the hand that feeds. They know it's that medical industry that's selling all these products.
Yes.
I talked to a guy who was, he's a young guy who was, this is just like about a year ago, close friend of mine, but a young guy just getting into the medical scene as he's getting employed, you know, and he was working for the city of New York, and I've been talking to him a lot about the fake viruses and the unnecessary vaccination and unnecessary application of drugs to children and all that stuff, and he said he just point blank asked his supervisors in the medical department of New York City, you know, oh, how come we're like this is really dangerous, right? What we're doing to these children, you know, we're doing this and that. And they said, yes, but we all recognize that. However, without these essentially a sales of medical products and all that, we wouldn't have these programs.
Right. We would not have our bureaucracy. Jim, we've run out of time. So
okay,
that was maybe a good way to end it. I don't know if you have any last words.
Well, I was hoping we'd get into Milan, but we ought to do that the next time, maybe sometime.
Well, yeah, I want to talk about the Milan epidemic of the 1600s, and if you've got feedback on it, why don't we do that together sometime?
Okay.
Okay, thanks, Jim, and goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to episode 185 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.